Welcome to Theology Thursday, an ecumenical space for students to discuss matters of faith and theology.
I'm your host, Connor Grubbs.
I am your co-host, Ryan Mock.
And I'm your co-host, Johnny Grubbs.
Also known as Bobby.
Today. I don't know why they keep calling me Bobby today.
Okay, so you want to know why I keep calling you Bobby? Because I texted you earlier today in the group chat that you two are part of. And it auto I typed in Johnny, but it auto corrected to Bobby.
Oh, I figured it was something.
I was pressing backspace. I was about to change it to Johnny. Then I'm like, wait a second, I'm just gonna leave it. And so now you're Bobby today.
According to autocorrect, autocorrect decides the fate of my name.
So as of the release of this episode, season 4 is officially longer than season 2.
I cannot wait to get on a new schedule.
Well, actually, you know, our seasons haven't been as off-kilter as they feel like they have been. Seasons 1 and 3 are both 26 episodes long. It's a nice, you know, there's some similarity there. Season 2 is the only one that ran a little bit shorter at 22 episodes.
And today we're at 27 for season 4?
No. I said this was one episode longer than season 2. Believe it or not, we're only on our 23rd episode of this season.
Really?
It feels like it's been forever. It
feels like we've been doing this, like, season 4 for like 2 years.
I went back and counted, and we literally just surpassed our shortest season. We haven't even gone in as long as the other two.
Well, we're not far from the other two.
No, we're not. So the question becomes, and maybe audience, you can help us decide, share in the comments your thoughts. We can either go till about halfway through April and cap it off right at 26 episodes, keep it in line with the other seasons, or we can go through the end of April and officially make season 4 the longest season of the podcast at 29 episodes.
You know, I vote for, not that my vote matters or anything, I don't know.
It doesn't.
But I think we should be consistent and stop at 26.
But here's the problem.
What?
If we really want to be consistent, we're going to have to go back to season 2 and make 4 more season 2 episodes. So that
if you really want to be super consistent, we could always... What episode are we on now this season? We just surpassed season 2. We should have stopped last week.
When was season 2 recorded?
And then we could have done 26, 22 every time.
Yeah.
When we were recording season 2, like, were we in this room or were we like elsewhere? Season 2 is when you're doing a lot of interviews.
There's a lot of interviews. So we would record intros in here. Well, and here's the thing. We have some bonus episodes that didn't fit into any season. There were about 3 of them. So let me think. 23, 24, 25. Man, season 2 is really close if you include the bonus episodes. It's really close.
Remind me and our audience what the new proposed schedule is.
Because you forgot?
I just want... Yeah.
So we had talked about 4 months, then 2 months off, 4 months, 2 months off.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So the idea is January to April we're going, and then, that doesn't work, does it?
Right, April, May, June, and then July we're back on.
Then
I didn't mean to turn this into
July we're back on, but if we do it that way, then there's no
July,
break.
August, September, October, November.
We'll just have to discuss this afterwards.
That's 6. December would be 6.
We should do it like a TV show. We should like take a break in the spring and take a break in the summer and be fall and winter. I forget how it is.
It should be like the school schedule.
We should just take the summers off?
Yeah, and then winter break.
Yeah.
Or maybe an extended winter break.
So we'll see.
We'll pray about it.
It might be like a...
We'll get back with you.
I'm not
so 26
episodes.
Here's the thing.
I'll pray about it.
I know season 2 throws us off a little bit. But without thinking about it or trying at all, we kind of have some uniformity in season. So do we want to try 26 episodes? Is that going to be the...
Yeah, I think that, I mean, if we're, this is we're having a meeting on air. Yeah, well, let's... Because
you're allowed to speak in.
If you want to, they're going to be like, every week. No, maybe not. Maybe they'll be like, shut up. Here's the thing, 26 definitely needs to happen.
You like that? That feels nice?
I like 26.
You know, I think some of the like, there's some usually shows are around 22 to 26 episodes a season, like a lot of... TV shows that actually, like, you know, now that we're getting into streaming and, like, premium television, that's, like, they're more limited series, but, like, before when we'd actually watch them on TV,
Yeah.
That was a... All right. Well, we'll talk about it afterwards. Sub point. Go ahead.
Let me get my story here.
It's Johnny's turn.
Just because there's probably going to be some quotes in here that I'm going to want to read off to you, but I'll go ahead and give you the skinny version of it. The Vatican came out today, and anytime the Vatican makes a statement, not that, this is like childhood stuff here. I mean, I'm not just, but just in case you're wondering, when a Vatican makes a statement, bless you, the Pope has approved that statement.
Right.
Yes, I have.
His Holiness approved.
His Holiness.
The papacy.
Okay.
Okay.
A pacifier?
I don't know. I'm just using Catholic jargon. Forgive me if I'm being disrespectful. Bottom line is, he approves the stuff that comes out of the Vatican. And the Vatican, just recently, in the past couple of the days, has decided to make it clear that while the Pope and, you know, maybe different clergy within the Catholic Church have been more friendly towards the LGBTQ community, we still cannot bless same-sex unions. That surprised me, especially since the Pope had to sign it.
I'm not surprised.
Okay, so I am and I'm not. I just think that in their current climate and with the fact that the Pope has said things, which, by the way, I've always said, and we've talked about it even on the podcast, you'd be like, the Pope says gay marriage is okay, and I've never heard him say that. He's never said that, really. He's said things to allude to that, and he said things to certainly denote that he's sympathetic to couples who are marginalized because maybe they're a same-sex couple or so forth. But he always left it open for an orthodox view within Catholicism.
He has explicitly told gay couples that they are not living in sin by being in a relationship.
Right. So, but, yeah, I don't know where...
The reason why I'm not surprised, though, is because while the whole... pro-LGBTQ thing is normal in our Western countries, our first world countries. That's not the case throughout the rest of the world. And we know that the center of Christianity is shifting to these more third world countries. So this is the same thing that happened in the United Methodist Church. Although the United Methodist Church does not have a pope,
rule in favor of... approving of same-sex marriages?
Well, the meeting I'm talking about, maybe they had a meeting even more recently, not that I know of, but they had a general assembly to vote whether to keep the decisions on this on a church-by-church basis, which is what it has always been, or are they going to formalize it that gay marriage is fine in the UMC? And so how the vote turned out was... It voted in favor of keeping it a church-by-church basis. And the reason why the votes swung that way is because the more conservative churches in places like Africa and South America voted as well. But if the vote was just for America, then it would have voted the other way to say we're going to formalize this in our actual official church documents.
Yeah, they have been... meaning to meet to revisit this for a couple years now, but it keeps being pushed off. Well, this would be the second time it's been pushed off because of COVID. But nonetheless, a more conservative-leaning Methodist denomination did spring off out of that, the Global Methodist.
So here's the thing. This is the kind of stuff that, like, Pope Francis has said, and I'd have to see that quote or see that situation, but like he said, things like homosexual people have the right to be in a family. They are children of God, right? That does not necessarily mean that he believes that that is God's will, although it is pretty affirming. This is the official statement, an excerpt of the official statement from the Vatican. The presence in such relationships of positive elements which are in themselves to be valued and appreciated cannot justify these relationships and render them legitimate objects of an ecclesial blessing. Since the positive elements exist within the context of a union not ordered to the Creator's plan. In other words, we can appreciate and value maybe things like monogamy and like a, because there are truly monogamous, very honoring of one another, same sex marriages, quote unquote, right? quote unquote, because we have a different definition of marriage, right? So basically, they're saying there's elements in there we can appreciate, but it's not an ecclesial marriage. It's not something that we, you know, that is. It's not they're not united by Christ in marriage. Is basically what they're saying,
right?
You know, so I mean, I'm putting a little bit into that, but I mean, that's what I garner from ecclesial blessing, right? It's not,
yeah,
this isn't God ordained. You know, maybe there's some good elements in it, but it's not that God doesn't see it as a union, is basically what they're continuing to stand by.
Which is more important than the government recognizing it as a union.
And I think what this opened up for me is, like, of course, everybody's, like, all up in arms about it. Like, oh, man, I thought we were making progress. And I just can't get around the idea that there are so many people that are saying it's harmful. It's harmful. If God doesn't see it as okay, like it tears, like I don't know. It's like, help me here. I'm just trying to figure out, I guess, I'm trying to figure out why it's so bad to make a theological statement about what God has ordained as a union of that nature, right? Like that is considered hateful, or you know what I mean? Like, I don't automatically hate a homosexual couple because I believe God doesn't approve of their lifestyle. Right? Am I crazy?
I don't think, I mean, you are crazy, but I mean, for different reasons, but I mean, I agree with you.
Right. I guess I'm just trying to get like into the mind of the other side of it to understand, because I feel like we're coming towards this, like, this either or decision where it's like, I don't know that we can't coexist.
Well, no, I mean, and that's, I mean, the world we're living in is, if you even say that there are two genders, male and female, like, you're a hateful person. It's not, there's no room for discussion on these things anymore.
Right.
We're becoming increasingly polarized.
Which is ironic, right? Because, and I know that we're banning the postmodern thing, and I know that, you know, has its own pitfalls, but it's kind of like, we're kind of past the days of your truth is your truth, and like we'd almost have a place to stand on, like that almost would be helpful to us as Christians now, to be like, well, the way that I see it is, you know. But like, I don't know, there's a lot of, this is like a bigger conversation, I don't know, it's a great sub point, there's a lot of conversation saying, if you're not totally affirming, like if the church is not totally affirming, I forget who it was, we can talk about him, he's so interesting, he wrote a book called Bad Theology Kills. I don't know if you guys have heard of that book. I don't know the author's name off the top of my head, but I stumbled upon his tweets through some friends and stuff like that. And his whole thing is like, if they're not totally affirming, leave, get out of there. They're not truly the church. They're not, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's just, there's no room for gray.
I think because of our strong polarization, when you make a stance for biblical marriage, when people look at you making that stance, they don't only see you're making a stance against for biblical marriage and against homosexual marriage. They also associate that with other things. So not only do you hate gay people, but you also hate women, probably, and you also hate black people, probably,
right.
And you probably hates Democrats, probably. All those other things are also lumped in there too. Just it's like a snowball effect. Our polarization.
I guess my question is, like, how do we get past that, right? Like,
well, it's interesting because part of what you're talking about, of the irony of it, is it's like we talked a while ago about deconstructionism, whatever that means. And I feel like there was this sort of like cultural, like societal deconstruction this Western version of Christianity that was far more conservative.
Yeah.
To, okay, let's take this apart. Your, you know, relative truth kind of postmodernism thing. And now that doesn't really work because you still have to have a solid ground to stand on. So people are reconstructing and coming on the opposite end.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the new truth. And, it is difficult to navigate that, you know?
And I don't want to be so apologetic that, like, we're, like, tiptoeing around and all that kind of stuff, but I feel like the church could have done a better job of communicating and even adding some caveats about, like, how they can include the LGBTQ community in the Catholic Church. You know, like, we should be embracing more LGBTQ people in our church and more trans people in our church, you know what I mean? But, like, I don't know that that changes, like, theological understanding,
Right. So, yeah, I think thus far the church hasn't found a way, by and large, the church has not found a way to embrace people without embracing their lifestyles. It's either we embrace all of it and we don't even acknowledge that there's sin,
mm-hmm.
or we just don't have these people in our church at all. And neither is the correct answer.
Right. And I think that, like, we're trying to be, like, a more diverse, like, nation, and trying to be more diverse, like, not just like racially, but like ideologically. And I don't know, I just feel like it's way more beautiful and way more diverse if I can sit across a table and we have totally different ethics regarding sexuality, but it doesn't like prevent us from having a good relationship with each other, like a loving, you know what I mean, like if I were friends with a family. I don't know what I'm trying to say. This is probably a bad sub point. Not very, very much fun, but
no, it's not fun at all, Bobby.
We'll
have fun on the after show. Become a Patreon.
I guess I'm just struggling with this more and more because we need to find a way in the church to communicate. Like, we don't have the same theological understanding about this issue, but like, it doesn't mean you're not welcome at our church. You know what I mean? Like for example, like one of the biggest things, like in the CNN article about this, and I read like every media outlet you could imagine about this morning, but the CNN article kept dogging on the fact that they chose to use the language of choice. You know, like people get mad when you talk about like homosexuality being a choice, and it's like, well, they didn't choose that, you know, and it's sort of like, okay, well, okay. You know, it's like, you have a choice. You have a choice. You could accept them and embrace them, and you could make the statement at the Vatican. They don't have a choice, you know? And so that logic is another thing that I'm just kind of like, I don't know. There's a lot of gay people that would disagree with you.
That they have a choice?
That they have a choice, you know?
Yeah, like you're saying, like, they're born that way?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, Christopher Yuan might even, like, we've talked about him before on the show, holy sexuality, and I don't want to have one scapegoat that I always go to, you know, but he's a great theologian, and he's a smart guy.
He's your gay scapegoat.
He's my gay scapegoat. I don't know that he really wants to lean into his identity in Christ. I don't know that.
A new Theology Thursday t-shirt. We all need a gay scapegoat.
This is what gets us in trouble. But, like, I don't know that he would fully say, like, I'm not attracted to men. I don't know that he can make that statement. I mean, like, he implies that heavily in his book. Like, he didn't abandon his, like he does have this innate attraction to men. Like, he's admitted that, you know. But he also doesn't say, I don't have a choice. You know, like, he has a choice to live in celibacy, which is what he's chosen to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's always a choice. Like,
yeah, a desire isn't necessarily a choice. I mean, right? Like, so you still choose what you're going to do based on that desire.
Right.
Like,
and that's where all the arguments come in. Well, that's kind of like lame. That now they have no chance of romance and all that stuff. And that's where some of Christopher Yuan's theology on singleness and stuff like really helps. But I just don't think it's fair, like, to say, like, I don't, like I've tried to use that argument with people, like, well, this is part of who I am, like because, like, my identity is in Christ, right? And so, like, if you're talking about identity, it's always about who I am. It's like, no, it's not part of who you are. It's a choice you made. And I'm like, well, you just told me my whole worldview is, like, wrong. Like,
it is.
What?
So.
You're wrong, Johnny.
And, yeah. I'm not even doing that. I don't know. It's weird. It's really weird. I don't think it's fair. I think it's lopsided. And sometimes it's lopsided the other way, too. I mean, sometimes evangelicals are jerks, and they're saying God hates fags on the side of the road. It happens, right? So, like, we got to meet in the middle because...
Bleep.
You're a little late there, buddy. I don't know. We should continue to have this discussion because it's going to become more prevalent in our churches. And, you know, Preston Sprinkle has some great stuff about this as well.
Press and Sprinkle?
Preston Sprinkle.
Press and Seal?
Preston.
He said Press and Sprinkle. Like...
He's a Christian thinker and author who has written extensively and researched extensively on these issues. And I actually haven't read all of his stuff. Maybe his stuff would help me understand better. But I think even some of his stuff, because I was listening to an interview with him the other day, it's like, yeah, I hear what you're saying. But, like, I have a devil's advocate statement from an LGBTQ person for everything you're saying. Like, how how do we actually create like healthy dialogue and healthy relationships? I don't understand. I'm trying to figure this one out.
Well, you know what will help us have a better understanding is three white guys talking about critical race theory.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, Ryan, I know that you did a lot of studying and you have some notes and you were like, hey, we could continue this discussion. So that's exactly what we're doing. We talked about critical race theory last week. I think you should check it out. We really focused on, is it okay for churches to engage critical race theory? And the conclusion is, in short, yes. But we didn't get too deep into what is critical race theory. We kind of gave a brief overview. But perhaps we could dig a little deeper. And Ryan, you even talked about how personally it has helped you, I guess, process and work through some things. So share, enlighten us, Ryan.
Right. So the first big question that we have to ask is, what is critical race theory? Because you see it all the time in the news and you hear about it at your church. But what is it? We talked about this last week briefly. We were answering the question, as Connor said, you know, is it dangerous to the church? But we didn't dive too deep into what it actually is. So I do want to provide a brief definition of what critical race theory is. And these are just simple definitions that I found just quick searching on the internet. You could do that too. Just Google critical race theory definition, and this is the kind of stuff that will pop up. Even though these are very simplistic definitions that I'll read for you, I do think that these properly represent the broad study of critical race theory. So simply put, critical race theory is an intellectual movement that seeks to understand how white supremacy as a legal, cultural, and political condition is reproduced and maintained primarily in the U.S. context. So that is one definition that you might pull up. And just to read another one, just to get a kind of broad overview of these definitions, critical race theory is the view that the law and legal institutions are inherently racist and that race itself, instead of being biologically grounded and natural, is a socially constructed concept that is used by white people to further their economic and political interests at the expense of people of color. According to critical race theory, racial inequality emerges from the social, economic, and legal differences that white people create between races to maintain elite white interests in labor markets and politics, giving rise to poverty and criminality in many minority communities. So I threw a lot of words at you. So to unpack that a little bit, there's a few key principles that we see in the study of critical race theory. The first one that I would point out is that critical race theory states that race is a social construct. Now, you have a comment?
This one really stood out to me because I want to know.
Stands out to a lot of people.
I want to know what they mean by it. And I also find it interesting if they're meaning what I initially gleaned from that is, are they essentially saying, okay, so there was a lot of talk about how, like, biologically, mm-hmm. we are technically all one race. Mm-hmm. There's just slight, you know, differences in the pigment of our skin, right? Like, but essentially, there is one human race.
Yes.
Is that what they're saying by race as a social construct?
So, yeah, this phrase throws a lot of people off guard to say, wait a second, race is a social construct. And it's kind of what you were saying, Connor. The reality...
Here's why I ask, and we can get into it in a second. But, like, literally Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis, like, did this whole video series on the fact that there's one human race.
Okay.
Well, so, no, I just find it interesting that a lot of conservative Christians actually would agree with one of the opening, you know, premises of critical race theory is that God created us all as one race. We came up with, you know, this thing on our own as time went on. It was part of these social constructs that were made. And it's fascinating to me that these same people are so terrified by critical race theory when one of its core premises is something that conservative Christians have been teaching for a while.
Right. So the idea of race is a social construct essentially means that the color of your skin is biologically based. The reason why I am white is because both my parents are white. And the reason why Connor is white is because both of his parents are white. The reason why somebody is black is because both their parents are black. Or the reason why somebody is mixed is because one of their parents is white and one of their parents is black. So the color of your skin is biologically based. But the idea that race itself is biological isn't necessarily the case. The question we're asking is, why do we group people by the color of their skin, right? Obviously, the color of your skin is an attribute of yourself and your ancestors, but why do we group you that way? That's what we mean when we say that race is a social construct. Race is a social construct just as much as a nation is a social construct, right? I am American, but that's only because I was born in America and I have both my parents are American. Now, there's not American blood running through my skin, running through my veins, but I am grouped with the American people.
You don't have American blood. I don't want you on this podcast anymore.
And so just as a nation is socially constructed, so is race. And a good example to help frame this is if you think about, anybody go back a thousand years back to Africa, what was Africa comprised of? Africa was comprised of many different people groups, and they grouped themselves by tribes. So if you took somebody in Africa on one side of the continent and told them that you are of the same people as a person on the opposite side of Africa, they're going to look at you like you're crazy, because even though they have the same color skin, they recognize that they are not the same people, right? Race is something that we've only socially constructed, that we've just grouped people this way. To say black people are a certain type of people and white people are a certain type of people, but it only runs skin deep. I want to let you speak in one second, Johnny, but just to conclude that thought, biologically speaking, there could be more similarities between me and a black person than there could be between me and Connor. If you just look at the DNA, it's literally only a few DNA differences that separate a white person from a black person. And so I could be more similar to a black person than I could than Johnny or Connor if we look at the DNA.
Surprisingly, Ken Ham would agree with you so far.
So that is surprising. That's the whole thing I want to unpack. So did you listen to Phil Fisher's interview with Lecrae? Okay, so here's my thinking. So that's a pretty neutral statement, though, right? They're not saying... This is a horrible thing.
We haven't gotten in the weeds yet.
Okay, so we're about to get in the weeds. And some of the problems that people might immediately assume, because we're all so defensive right now and stuff like that. So you say that, and then somebody might say, well, what about diversity? You know, like that, like just, but you're not saying, and CRT doesn't state, I'm assuming that just that because it's a social construct that like different cultures and stuff are bad.
Right, yeah. CRT doesn't state that. They don't just because race is a socially constructed thing doesn't mean it's bad.
Doesn't mean diversity is a bad thing. Right. Because that was one of the things in the interview that which I encourage anybody to go listen to, Phil Fisher on the Holy Post interview Lecrae, and how he was in the evangelical space with his records and stuff like that, and how he was ostracized not for being edgy or if they're just being unapologetically black. There is a culture,
yes,
there, you know,
just like in America we have our national culture,
right?
And just as America is socially constructed, there's nothing wrong with American culture,
right?
Inherently,
right? And he goes a step further and even talks about how there really is no one American culture, but
that's a discussion for a different time.
But
well, just a quick but there is a black culture application while we're thinking about like the difference between There is a difference between ethnic diversity and cultural diversity.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think
too.
A lot of churches really, like, I was talking to somebody about this the other day about the fact that a lot of churches strive for diversity, but really all they're striving for is ethnic diversity. They want to have some black people on their staff. They want to have some Hispanic people on their staff because now they can say, hey, look, we're diverse. And that's good. I think we need to be intentional about diverse leadership, and beyond tokenism, like genuinely, authentically diverse leadership. But it has to be culturally diverse, not just ethnically diverse, because a lot of times we want, you know, different ethnicities represented maybe in the leadership of our church, but only if they adapt to the white culture of the church. And I think there is a way to blend cultures, and it's going to require a lot of conversations, a lot of intentionality. But it's important because really heaven is described as this blend of cultures, you know, coming together to worship Jesus.
Well, and I think that's why some people get all like up in arms right away, as they're like, well, diversity is a good thing. But I think sometimes there's an ulterior motive there of what you really mean is having our own suburban pockets is a good thing, unfortunately. And that's where it gets a little bit messy.
Okay, so I want to get to my second point. So the first point is that race is a social construct. I think most people, if they think about that for just a few moments, I think most people can agree with that. Even our Ken Ham folks. You know, that's something that Ken Ham says. We're all just one human race. So I think everybody mostly agrees with that if they think about it. Race is a social construct. So what's the next principle? This is even the second principle I think most people agree with. And the second principle is this. Race is a social construct that white people have used to oppress people of color historically. So throughout history, white people have used race to oppress other people. I think most people agree with that, right? I think slavery, the chattel slavery of the 19th century was oppressive to black people. I think everybody agrees with that. I think that the Jim Crow laws and the black codes...
Unfortunately, there's a large number of people that agree with that.
Large number of people. Not everybody agrees with that.
I was reading Be the Bridge, which is also an organization about racial reconciliation. And this lady was talking, a black lady was talking about how she was at her son's ball game. And there was a white couple there saying, well, you know, the slavery, you know, asking her questions. And it finally got around to, you know, well, the slavery really wasn't that bad. Like some of those people had better lives, you know, as slaves than they would have if they had.
Yeah, there's a lot of dumb things going on
there. Right, so I'm just saying, like, there are people today that sit there and say, well, I don't know that we've historically oppressed black people.
So if you disagree, with that statement that slavery was oppressive to black people, I highly suggest that you do some research. I think it's crystal clear as we study history that chattel slavery of the 18th century, particularly, I mean, all of it was oppressive. In that time period, but slavery was oppressive to black people in America. So most people who have a solid understanding of history, I'll say,
sorry,
agree with that white people have oppressed black people in history. The third principle is a little harder to swallow for a lot of people. It's the idea that racism itself can be a systemic issue, that actually it's racism is not just an individual hating somebody for the color of their skin, but it could actually be a whole system that oppresses a certain group of people based on the color of their skin. That's a harder pill to swallow for a lot of people, but what has helped me think about it is that first off, historically, we've had systems that oppress people, right? Slavery in the 19th century in America, I think it's really hard to disagree with the idea that slavery in the 19th century was systemically racist. I think it's really hard to disagree with that idea because slavery itself, it was an institution. Right. It was an institution that was recognized by the federal government. And all of society was involved in it. Scholars say that slavery accounted, both slavery and the slave trade and the whole system there accounted for 15% of the Southern economy. Now, I can't think of anything today, one particular thing that is 15% of our economy. 15% is a really big deal. And no, whichever way you look at it, everything was involved in the whole system of slavery, even the North. We like to think that the North was this bastion of racial equality, but the North was just as racist, just a little under the covers. I mean, think about the cotton that slaves were picking. Where was the cotton being sent to? It was being sent up North. And so even the workers in the factories up North were involved in this, they had their hand in this in some way. So I think it's really hard to argue that slavery in the South was not systemic. Furthermore, there are other examples we could think of systemically wrong systems. And an example I would use is the Indian caste system, which, if you're familiar with history, in India, there's been for thousands of years a caste system based on the kind of family you were raised in, and this caste system oppressed you. I think something like a caste system is inherently oppressive. And a really good book that I would recommend is called Caste by Isabel Wilkerson. And what she does in her book, she draws comparisons between the Indian caste system and the oppression of black people in America throughout history. And there are some very striking similarities between how the caste system in India worked and how oppression of black people in America has worked for the past 200, 250 years. So I think it's not hard to jump to the conclusion that racism can be systemic, because I think we could see that throughout history. The final principle that I want to talk about, because CRT is a very broad study, right? We could spend hours talking about this, but the last principle I want to particularly talk about is this. This is the hardest pill for people to swallow. America today is systemically racist. There is systemic racism in America today. So not only was there systemic racism in America in the past, but there's also systemic racism today. I'm sure that is the hardest pill to swallow for a lot of people.
And I think one of the reasons why it is hard for people to swallow is because they tend to, well, there's many, many reasons, but a lot of people tend to define systemic racism in their own way really very quickly. But you kind of just said it. It's an institution that favors one race over another, right?
Yes.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know why that's a tougher pill for us to swallow.
I don't know why.
We have so many institutions where it's very obvious the prison system.
And the prison system was what I was going to use as an example.
Right. Even our law enforcement system. I mean, again, it's not like I'm saying like I'm against police and I'm like, but that's an institution that often favors
I just want to throw white people. A few stats at you. I know people sometimes complain about stats, but stats oftentimes help us look at certain debates. So I'll throw a few stats at you. An October 2019 report in the Los Angeles Times found that during traffic stops, 24% of black drivers and passengers were searched, compared with 16% of Latinos and 5% of whites. The same study also found that police were slightly more likely to find drugs, weapons, or other contraband among whites. Yet black people are being searched at 24%. Of all traffic stops, and whites only 5%. Another study, National Study of Misdemeanor Arrests, published in 2018 in the Boston University Law Review, found that the black arrest rate is at least twice as high as the white arrest rate for disorderly conduct, drug possession, simple assault, theft, vagrancy, and vandalism. The black arrest rate for prostitution is almost five times higher than the white arrest rate, and the black arrest rate for gambling is almost 10 times higher. A 2020 ACLU report found that even in the era of marijuana reform, black people are more than 3.5 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana offenses than whites, even though blacks and whites use marijuana at basically the same rate. A survey of data from the U.S. Sentencing Commission in 2017 found that when black men and white men commit the same crime, black men on average receive a sentence almost 20% longer. Mm-hmm. The research controlled for variables such as age and prior criminal history. And so those are a lot of stats, and I'll give you one more stat, but to preface this stat, the idea behind systemic racism is not only can one component of the system be racist, but it could spread to other components. And this stat will show you what I mean. 1 in 13 African Americans of voting age is disenfranchised, a rate more than 4 times greater than that of non-African Americans. Over 7.4% of the adult African American population is disenfranchised, compared to 1.8% of the non-African American population. In 4 states, Florida, 21%, Kentucky, 26%, Tennessee, 21%, and Virginia, 22%, more than 1 in 5 African Americans is disenfranchised. And disenfranchised means basically you can't vote. And so in many states, including Florida, in the United States, if you have a felony, you can't vote. And so I don't know if it's actually – it might have changed in Florida. I think they're kind of reforming the law there, which is good if they are. But in many states, this is the case. And so not only does that kind of problem affect the prison system, we see that the prison system can be systemically racist, but it also affects the franchise, meaning who can vote. So now less black people are able to vote, and less black people being able to vote equals less representation, which if you have less representation for your people or whatnot, that leads to more problems. And so that's how systemic racism spreads.
Let me just loop this back around, because I know we've been going for a long time already, and this is Theology Thursday, right? And so, like, how does this relate theologically? Is very, very important. And I get this question all the time, because I've talked about those things with people before, and they'll be like, whoa, 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 systemic racism, you're being political, right? And it is a theological issue, and it's a theological issue for a lot of reasons, but I'll direct you to one example, or maybe two. You look at the Samaritan woman and Jesus at the well, right? There was a system in place that said Samaritans, which were a mixed race, they were basically, you know, the Jews considered them mutts, right? Because they had
Jew and Gentile.
Right, exactly. And so there was this, they created an institution that divided and favored, you know, the Jewish people above Samaritan people. To where they would go around. Jesus shouldn't have even been on that road. I mean, he should have, because he's God and he's sovereign. Sorry, but you know what I mean. Like culturally speaking, he should have gone around just to not be near that person, right? Just to not be near those people. And so, you know, that was just one example. But people would say, well, the gospel then solves that, right? Because like once the gospel came along, it's like yeah, but what the gospel did was work in people's hearts and lives to end systems of racism, right? All of a sudden, the Gentiles and Jews were eating at the same table. All of a sudden, you know, the Samaritan and Jewish divide began to dissipate, but it required them to actually do something about the systems. It required them to stop going the long way around. It required them, you know, and that's all inferred, right? I mean, that's not in scripture, but we know that there. It's not just that they all prayed a prayer, and now they like each other. You know what I mean? Like they actually started to see those lines break down. And so I just don't understand why people want to differentiate. Your theology is going to affect the way you approach the world.
Yes,
including the institutions that you're a part of.
Yeah, I want to talk to my Calvinist friends out there for a moment. For some reason, a lot of Calvinists don't like this, don't like CRT. And it boggles my mind, because systemic racism should be a thing that makes total sense in Calvinism, right? Because of total depravity, right? The idea that once sin entered the world, it seeped into everything, not only us, but in creation. And so sin affects not only us, but it affects the systems that we create. So I don't understand why it's such a hard pill to swallow that racism could be systemic. And that boggles my mind. And then the other thing about Calvinists is Calvinists love people like Abraham Kuyper and whatnot, and the whole idea of sphere sovereignty, which basically says we as Christians, we need to be involved in the different spheres in our life. And that involves stuff like education, the government, the arts, and whatnot. So as Christians, we have, it should be pretty clear to us, particularly Calvinists who love sphere sovereignty, we should have a duty to go into the different spheres in our life and eliminate oppression and eliminate the problems in our society. And there's plenty of problems, poverty, racism, among other things. So I totally think that this idea is compatible not only with Christian thought, but also Calvinist thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And even in the apostles had to write to these issues, like, because they were different cultures and different people. And like the Jews didn't want, you know, Peter had that struggle with eating with the Gentiles and stuff like that. Like, we have so many examples of it wasn't just about, yes, okay, great, you've accepted the gospel, but the gospel means that there's neither Jew nor Greek nor slave nor free, you know, like that whole thing, that whole spiel, you know what I mean? And so he was saying, hey, this affects everything, you know? And so I think what the problem that people face is they think that they're mutually exclusive, that if we start talking about systemic change, we're minimizing the gospel. And no, we're saying that that because you've been saved, you that should naturally transfer into systemic change. Like you're going to spread the kingdom and the institutions that you're a part of. Hopefully you are, you know, but that's a whole other issue where evangelicals become a cultural thing that we adopt versus an actual faith.
I've just heard so many people lately saying, oh, we don't need social justice, we need the gospel. And people are talking about social justice and they're trying to tag it onto the gospel or whatever. But if you don't want to call it social justice, fine. We need to be loving people, yeah. Right? I mean, that's what it boils down to. But it does require us first recognizing like where things are wrong. And I think a lot of people are operating under the assumption that, oh, well, you know, they're black people and people of different colors, they aren't oppressed anymore. Like they have the freedom and the option to that. That's honestly a big perspective. Like, you know, we've eradicated a lot of, you know, they can vote now and we can, and there's just this thought of like, well, it's not an issue anymore. It's their choice. It's their responsibility. And that's why I think like examples like, I mean, I think prison is a huge example, because what you talked about with like coming out and you have a felony charge and you're not able to vote anymore. Well, I mean, that's just one of many things that coming out of prison.
Right. There's many more problems.
You're not able, in a lot of communities, you're not able to apply for a mortgage. You're going to have a much harder time getting a job. And if blacks are getting arrested more than whites and they're coming out of that without the ability, they're being kept down because they have so many rights stripped away from them coming out of prison. They don't have the ability to get back on their feet, you know? And those are things that we do need to recognize.
And we don't have time to get into all of it today, but there's also like some of the retrospective stuff that has ripple effects today that we have to look at, which still creates a favoring of one race over the other. You know, I think of the war on drugs, I think of redlining. Those, the fallout of those things has never been like objectively addressed, you know, because we live in a predominantly white culture. And it's, I mean, like to say that we need to face the music on those things as a culture or as a community or as a country, like, why is that? I just don't understand why that's a problem for so many Christians. Sorry if that's a soapbox hot take. If you're listening and you're like, oh, you heathen, you woke liberal freak. But the reality is, it's just, I'm tired of it, you know, like well, it's just a reality.
And people, I think, hear, they hear virtue signaling, they hear white guilt, they hear self-hate, and that's not what we're calling for. What we're calling for is to love your neighbor as yourself,
right?
You know, like, it's, and that requires acknowledging some hard truths, some of these things that are just like historical facts. We shouldn't be arguing with them. Like, there shouldn't even be room for that, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's kind of like, whoops, we didn't finish the civil rights movement, you know? I mean, yeah. it's that simple. Like, this, we're just not done. We're not done with all these things that, you know, have we made progress. I mean, I think that's fair to say as well, but like, it's not done.
And no, this conversation, this issue doesn't replace the gospel, because without the gospel, it is futile.
Right.
It's a futile fight. But if we're going to say that we love people, if we're going to say that we care about redemption, then we can't ignore these things.
Yeah, James chapter 2, I can't remember which verse, says, true religion is this, that you would, what is it? That you would look out for the orphans and the widows.
Yeah.
And so that's a pretty bold claim. Like, this is true religion, that you would feed the widows and the orphans. And I think the Bible thematically also adds to that, the oppressed and the downtrodden.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, you see, even, you know, and we've talked before about how people often view, you know, the God of the Old Testament as this mean, angry God, and then they see the God of the New Testament as almost a different character. And we've addressed that before and tackled that issue. But the fact is even in the Old Testament, we see the laws, you know, the Mosaic laws and all of these things that are in place protect the foreigner and the oppressed and the poor, like people outside of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And really the only people that we see outside of Israel that are, like, the law explicitly protects are the poor and the oppressed.
Proverbs 31 verses 8 through 9. This is the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and the needy.
Yeah, if you look at the ancient Near Eastern like concept, especially among the Jews, of justice, which was actually unique to other ancient Near Eastern cultures, it's amazing. I mean, like, this shouldn't be controversial for Christians, because it's like all over the scripture, and particularly the Old Testament, the way that it defines justice and making sure that everybody's on an even field. Everybody had an opportunity to become a part of God's family, even in ancient Israel. That's a whole other conversation we can have, and it happened a couple of times. From start to finish, it's very clear what we're supposed to be about. So,
Connor, do you have a topic for the after show? Because I have something I want to talk about.
What do you want to talk about, Ryan?
I want to talk about the Tampa Bay Rays.
Okay, well, we'll talk about the Tampa Bay Rays on the after show, so go become a patron. Give us your money. Ryan?
Yeah, I eat.